Game on 2FM with Green Farm. Fuel your day with Green Farm's new high-protein cooked chicken breast fillets. 100% natural and packed with flavour.
It's Monday, the 29th of November, and this is Game On. Coming up today, there's a new man in charge at Manchester United. Alan Colley and Stephen Kelly will discuss that and all of the weekend's soccer action.
A man that Stephen O'Donnell wanted at his club, Robbie Benson, to step forward. Robbie Benson to score! St. Pat's to win the cup!
Will the United Rugby Championship survive Omicron? Keane Tracy has the latest on Munster's departure from South Africa.
Frawley. Oh, for ball, the intercept, and Hume. Can he go all the way? James Hume can go all the way. Ulster have the victory. And it's celebrated almost like they've won the league here. And who would blame them?
And Ruby will look back at all the weekend's racing action at Newbury, Newcastle and Ferry House.
It's Honey Sockett and Rachel Blackmore on the unbeaten champion hurdlers safely over. They took their time. Ronald Pump is in second and then Abacadabra. Honey Sockett and Rachel Blackmore. They're a remarkable combination. Season in, season out. Three Hatton's Grace hurdles.
If you want to get in touch, you can text us on 51552 or tweet at GameOn2FM.
GameOn2FM.
Saint-Marie, Liverpool won 4-0, but Temple Oak United ladies lost 4-0, did you?
We lost 4-0, but it was our very first game, so it's funny you bring that up, Ruby. I'm not sure how you knew or found out about that, considering you're not on social media. But yeah, Temple Oak United have a new women's team, and I joined it a couple of weeks ago, and we had our very first match. But it's just social, it's just fun, it's good crack, and it's just women that are mothers, they're others, they want to go out and play a little bit of football. There was two girls that I met there who work for Lidl HQ, and they play mothers and others. They do tag rugby social, they do now this women's soccer team, because when they were young, they were telling me that they weren't encouraged to play sport, and now there's all these brilliant opportunities where you don't have to be competitive. There was a girl from Spain, she didn't want to join a competitive league, she saw it on social media, she joined. Women coming from Artane, Dunleary, and we all just went and played a football match, and it was brilliant, except that my sons and their friends were all on the sideline roaring at me for the whole lot of it every time I went near the ball.
And what did they say when you went home after getting beaten 4-0?
Well, the analysis...
Were they proud of mummy?
Well, no, they weren't. They said, I have a huge amount of work to do. I'm so unfit that I should have scored about 4 goals. What was wrong with my decision making? Have I not been practicing my finishing? They were absolutely brutal.
Were they happy with your tracking back, though?
No, they were happy with... I don't think they were really happy with anything. They liked our jerseys, that was about it. But the standard of play now wasn't up to scratch at all. They were a little bit nearly embarrassed, I think, because we didn't win. But no, they were delighted that we were all playing for the same team. And I did put it up on social media because I've never played on the same team as them. I've played for different clubs and different sports. And as Alan knows, I played for St. Pat's for 10 years and then played a little bit of Gaelic football up here in Dublin. But never have I played on or wore the same jersey as my kids. And it was amazing. Like, it was so good. And even seeing their friends and a couple of the lads that I coached in the academy, they all came up, and it just felt like we were all part of something really. It was like just like a big family, and it felt like family time, even though I was out playing football and they were looking after themselves on the line. Like, it did actually feel like...
The big question will be, Marie, will they go next week? That'll be the test of time.
I have an army of fans now, Ruby. You're just jealous.
I am very, very jealous.
I do. I think it's brilliant. We need to get Ruby out on the pitch. I want to see Ruby playing football, to be honest with you.
I'll tell you one thing now. Use some cheek as well. Invite me to a cup final. I'd have got some hiding if I went to that in Irish town.
No. Are you bringing this up?
That was some carry on, wasn't it? You come to the cup final, huh? I'm driving home from Ferry House yesterday, and all I can hear is what's going on. I mean, God, Alan, I almost felt sorry for the cup final when I saw that.
And well, that's the thing, Ruby. It was an unbelievable occasion. There was nearly 40,000. It broke the Aviva record. And for me, it was absolutely brilliant. Two brilliant sets of supporters. And 20 thugs tried to ruin it, intent on causing trouble and chaos. And it did cause a lot of trouble and chaos, from what I gather. But I certainly wouldn't let that take away from the occasion. And I shouldn't think that should be the focus point today on what was a brilliant occasion. Brilliant sets of supporters. There wasn't a hint of anything in the ground. I know loads of people. My son was there with his little team. Loads of coaches brought their teams along, their kids along. It was a real family atmosphere, a brilliant atmosphere in the ground as well, I must say. And when I was getting the videos and the WhatsApps of this stuff going on and hearing as well, I was disgusted, really. But I wouldn't let 20, as I say, thugs who were just intent on causing trouble and chaos try to ruin what was a brilliant occasion.
it's not a reflection either, Ruby, of the League of Ireland on a weekly basis. Alan goes to Daly Mount all the time. I go to Tala with the lads pretty much every night. There's a home game up there since we've been allowed back in again. And I've never seen any trouble. There's no defending what happened. Like, it was an absolute disgrace. And anyone that was in the area, I would understand the fear and the disgust. But that isn't what the League of Ireland is about. And it's not my experience of the League of Ireland.
I know it's not. And you're going to defend it as well, Alan. But unfortunately, in every sport, in every walk of life, a small few can ruin it for everyone. Mm. And that's the brush then that everyone gets tired with. And people have to remember that in every sport.
Yeah, absolutely, Ruby, and that's fair. But certainly, as Marie would said, I would back up everything that she says and echo that, because as long as I've been following the League of Ireland, then involved as a player, and obviously now going to games in the capacity that I do, and I'm at games every week, and it's not just Daly Mount, I go to Tala, I go all around Dublin to games, the showgrounds, I was in Ballybuffet recently, every club in the country, and you might get the odd little incident, but that's all it is the odd little incident anywhere. And that, yesterday what I went on, is by no means a reflection. And we're trying to change the face of the league here, Ruby, in terms of entice supporters. Obviously, we have a laugh and a joke when I say I'm going to bring you to a game someday, and I'd love you to come to a brilliant rivalry with Shamrock Rovers and Bohemians. That's the game I will bring you to, because that's the game you will love. And there is an intense rivalry, but it rarely spills into idiots causing trouble like that in terms of what we saw yesterday. So I would absolutely 100% defend the league and defend the supporters and defend St. Pat's and Bohemian supporters that were there yesterday, because I'm in Inchicore every week, or I'm in Daly Mount, and I never ever come across any scenes like what we saw in a couple of those videos.
Yeah, and like, it was disappointing as well today to see other sports kind of just using it against the sport of football as well. You know, I've seen plenty of brawls and fights in other games on the pitch, but it has never put me off going back to another match again.
That's unfortunately what happens. It's almost like everyone has to, you know, knock the other sport to try and make their own more popular. And I don't know, is that a great psyche or culture? And I think we're all guilty of it. If you can down another sport to big up your own, and that's what happens, you end up picking holes in it.
Yeah, that does go on a lot, Ruby. I see that, and especially we speak a lot about social media, and that does go on. Why people do that, I never really understand that. I love Gaelic, I love going to hurling, GAA matches, obviously incidents happening in Gaelic, as Marie said, on the pitch and stuff, but that would never deter me from of my kind of liking to go to a match and lads involved, and especially rugby or whatever. That I'm not the biggest rugby fan, but I would never try and use one against the other, because people have a right to go and support whatever sport it is they like and whatever they enjoy. And to be fair, I think in this country as well, like, I lived in England for 4 years and I saw stuff going on there in terms of, we all know the hooligan element of what goes on in English football or around that. You'd never see anything like that in terms of all the sports here. I wouldn't just say soccer, Gaelic, the odd incident that we see on the pitch, which is obviously terrible, but you rarely see anything like what you could class as hooligan behaviour in terms of any of the sports.
Bohemians have just released a statement about what happened before the game. So they pointed out that 37,126 fans attended. It was an absolute record breaker. They had 18,000 fans behind their team, which was unprecedented for their club. And they say that it is therefore all the more deeply regrettable that the deplorable actions of a tiny minority before the game would take away from that and tarnish such an occasion between the two clubs. They condemn the behaviour of that minority, and they are going to, and the Gardaí are going to investigate it, and they're going to ban anyone that is identifiable in footage of the incidents. They point out that they're 100% fan-owned club, and their volunteers have worked tirelessly to be a force of good in their community on many fronts, and they just want to assure their members and the supporters that they will not allow the actions of this minority to detract from that continued aim.
Alan, you're a way better promoter of the League of Ireland than Marie. You had it at nearly 40,000. She had to go at the exact 37,100 and take the 2,900 away. But anyway, what about the game? 40 sounded better, Marie. Nearly 40 sounded better. You drum it up there.
That was amazing, Ruby. It really was a record-breaking crowd, as we've heard. It was just a special occasion, a special atmosphere. The fact that it was a Dublin derby probably added to it, in the sense that it was probably, for the purest sense of the way, that it was the north side versus the south side. Two clubs with a massive history. The fact that they never met in a final was an incredible start, really, in the build-up to it. And the build-up to the final was all about how do we separate these teams, because they were very, very closely matched in all the games that they played this year. I know Pat's finished second, but Bo's finished fifth. But even in terms of that, they're all the games that I had seen with those teams involved, it was very, very hard to separate, and there wasn't much between the teams at all. going into the final. That's exactly the way it played out as well. I thought St. Pat's had the better of it for the first half an hour. Tactically, Stephen O'Donnell came up with a ploy to try and basically play without a centre forward and kind of incorporate the fact that he could get Forrester and Benson in those central areas where his two most dangerous players that he wanted. If anything, it worked in terms of them gaining possession and gaining a huge advantage for the first half an hour, but they lacked the cutting edge. And if anything, Bowes probably had the better chances on the counter attack. The second half, I felt Bowes were the better team. And once Georgie Kelly went off, though, I just felt they lost that presence that they had with Georgie, even though Georgie wasn't maybe at his best and he looked like a lad who had obviously not played in the last three or four games, but I just felt they lost that focal point. And the young lad that came on, Promise Amachera, didn't offer as much as maybe what Georgie might. Then when it went to extra time, I thought the two goalkeepers were absolutely outstanding, and that was the reason it went to extra time. Both Talbot and Yaris pulled off two or three unbelievable saves. Pats were the stronger in extra time, and when they got the goal, an unbelievable goal, I'm not sure if you saw it, Ruby, but
it was deserving of winning any cup final, wasn't it?
It really was. Chris Forrester, and he's a special talent, and he's a special person as well. He's been through a lot in his 28 years of being around, and he's been through a lot of personal tragedy himself, mental health issues, different things like that, but he's come out of it really a better person, and he's some player. And the goal that he scored was absolutely phenomenal. And to be fair, at that point I couldn't see Bowes replying, and then they go up and score straight away into the second period of extra time. And this normally tends to happen, that for 90 minutes you can't separate them, and then it all explodes in extra time. And that's been the case in two or three of the finals. But when it did go to penalties, it's a sorry way to see any team lose a final. And I know Keith Ward, he's a real infectious character, a great lad, everybody loves him.
We've had him on the show.
He's a lovable little lad, everybody, as I say. And for him to miss, because he has a real connection with Bowes, he's there a long, long time, the fans love him, and I felt so sorry for Keith Ward missing. And it is, we've always said it, no matter what the tournament, what the competition, when you lose on penalties, it's a horrible way to lose. And I did feel for Bohemians, but maybe St. Pat's did just shade it on the day.
Yeah, I felt so sorry for Keith Ward as well. And I thought, even when he came on, I was there thinking to myself, Keith Ward's going to come on here, get the winner, and be the Bowes hero.
And he did do well when he came on, really, and he set up he obviously took the corner for the goal as well. And when he stepped up, because we're obviously, as they're coming up, you're kind of predicting between ourselves in the studio and saying, well, and I really fancied Wardy, even Stewie beside me. Stewie said, I can't see Wardy missing. And then, of course, it does happen. And I felt so bad for him. But as I say, over the course of the 120 minutes and the penalties, I think Pat's probably did shade it.
Stephen is with us on the line as well. Stephen, just on something Alan pointed out about the fact that it feels like there's always extra time and penalties. So of the 12 FAI Cup finals, 9 have, this is in the Aviva, 9 have gone to extra time, 5 to penalties, and of the 3-1 in 90 minutes, 2 were won by a single goal, and the third was 2-0 with Christy Fagan scoring in the 94th minute. They've all been absolutely down to the wire. What is it about Cup finals that players just find it really hard to go out and win them?
There's an edginess and there's a reluctance as a team to go out and just go for it, because there's so much at stake in that one-off game. And often in a cup final, unless there's a real underdog situation with, Alan was saying, these teams are very closely matched throughout most of the season, so they knew what each other were capable of, and they didn't want to just go gung-ho for it because they knew they'd probably get picked apart. So when teams are a bit sketchy and they're a bit kind of edging on the side of caution, it's rarely they go out and just go for it. You know, you see City in the UK have wiped the floor with Watford, but that's a mismatch. It's rarely this happens, and when teams are closely matched, they're very reluctant to just go for it. They want to get through the game, try and nick it by one goal and stay in it for as long as they can and kind of pick the team off.
Alan, that's reflective of every sport. It's the fear of losing, and people stop playing to win. They only try not to lose. Was that what you saw yesterday, maybe, for a while?
Yeah, I think you probably hit on something there, Ruby, and it's probably fair to say when you do get to a cup final, there might be that fear of losing, all right? But I don't think the players, to be fair to them yesterday, or the teams, played in any negative way. It was just the fact that they were so closely matched. It was very, very hard to separate them, as we've outlined even in the build-up. It was, as I say, it was very much 50-50, and that's kind of the way it transpired. What I found, the longer the game went on, then you get to the point where it is that fear of losing. You don't want to be the one that makes that mistake or makes the error. So instead of playing that maybe adventurous pass that you may have played, or try and play a pass that a creative one, you're trying to maybe keep it safe rather than trying that and be a bit more as I say, a bit more adventurous in what you're thinking or what you're trying to do. And I felt, and something as well, it's interesting that Marie outlined those stats, because we were saying it yesterday about the nine finals going to extra time, and it's incredible, really. Bohemians, that was their 47th match of the season, because of course they had the run in Europe, and there was fellas going down with cramp after 65-70 minutes. I just think the whole season caught up on them, and it's interesting that obviously the cup final always comes after the league, and it's our showpiece day out, it's our big occasion, it's a massive pitch. These players are not used to the build up in terms of not only what it takes out of you physically but also mentally, and it just drains the life out of you. And when you get to that stage where a lot more mistakes happen, a lot more errors, I say the quality did probably go out of the game from about the 60th minute on, and you could almost sense in some ways that it was going to either hinge on a moment of magic like we saw with Chris Forrester, or that it would maybe go to penalties.
Stephen, I don't know, did you see the shootout? I watched it all again this morning, but I know you'd see goalkeepers doing different things in penalty shootouts, but James Talbot striding out, throwing the ball away, the referee corrected him the second time. Maybe people say there's an edge there. To me, it was slightly unsporting. Did you
he
see
hit someone on, he hit one of the lads in the head.
Yeah, but he
he
wasn't looking, to be fair.
He did apologise. Yeah, anyone ever was had to go for ages to get the ball
back.
He didn't
mean that. He didn't mean, there's a bit of madness about him.
I think it's weird. I think for goalkeepers, right, and listen, I've never been one to take penalties, so I can't really judge lads that go and miss or take one. But for a goalkeeper, if you're shooting a ball, goalkeeper from 12 yards, Ruben, if you're just stood in the penalty spot, you shouldn't really miss. And listen, this is me who's never taken one before. But for him to have any advantage he possibly can, I don't think it's a sportman. I think they have to do that. And I think for a goalkeeper, they're well in the rights. Like now, they literally have to stand on the line. They can't move. You know what I mean? They're so restricted. They can't come off the line. They can't close down the space. They're so restricted to what they can use to their advantage. I think beforehand, if you can get a little bit of, you know, mental games going to put them off in any way to stop a striker or stop a player scoring against you, I think fair dues, do it. Take it on, because it's, you know, fine lines, fine margins win games. And, you know, if that's what it does to cause you to win a match, then so be it.
Ruby, I'm with Stephen in the sense that the dark arts is what we call it, and you do what you have to do to win a match. I would love to ask you the question, is it the equivalent of if you're coming up the rail on a horse and you're blocking a fell in and you don't want to let him out? I've often heard you say that can be good race riding, or is there a bit of dark arts involved in that as well?
Absolute dark arts. But
there you go.
But the best part about dark arts is they're supposed to be dark, not obvious. That's why they're called dark arts.
Well, I've yet to hear about the bright arts.
You know what I mean? You don't get caught when you're at the dark arts. That's you know what I mean?
But that is the equivalent, Ruby. Like, as Stephen said, you do what you can to win. I actually felt, now this is how cynical players become and thinking. When Chris Forrester takes that touch, right, and it's an amazing touch, if you look back on the goal, a lot of people probably won't even go back as far as his first touch to actually get him into the position where he's by Buckley and he's breaking down on the back four. But that touch made the goal. It was amazing. But if you look at Promise Amachere, who the ball bounced off, and unfortunate for him, he should have done better, but the ball bounced off him, and in him trying to retrieve that and running back, he should have fouled Chris Forrester on the half line. Took a yellow card and bang, Forrester never would have scored. In his naivety, and he's only 20, I think, the young lad, he's very young, he chased him the whole way back and chased him and chased him, and then Forrester flicked it back onto his right foot and buries it on the edge of the box. He should never, ever have got near the edge of the box, because Promise should have dragged him down on the half line and he would have got a yellow card. That would have been the end of it, and Forrester never would have scored.
Alan, will St. Patrick
hang on? You've absolutely read my mind, Carly. Sorry.
Go on, Stephen.
He's read my mind there. He's absolutely read my mind there. So I was watching it going, just take him out. Just pull him down. Like, it's horrible to say that. And as a player, you want to be fair. But, you know, it's those fine margins, those things that cost you a match or ever. And you just see him going through. And it's inexperience, not being in a position like that before. And maybe it's just not in your nature. But at times like that, you have to just, you know, do the horrible things and take the card for your team, knowing that you're in a position where you're not going to get sent off. It might affect you later on the game. But at that moment in time, you're still going to stay on the pitch and doing the right thing. Like, he's not going to know he's going to go on and finish it the way he did, you know. But at that moment, you think, just take him out, take a card.
Marie, now we're getting the real truth out of these two. People think they're really nice, you know, Adam and Stephen are so nice. Actually, they're a pair of foul cynics, the two of them. They both thought the very same way of what to do, the same thing. See, eventually you break people down if you keep talking to them, Marie.
The poor young lad, he's only 20. He learned that as he progresses.
Yeah, and like, that's another thing with Bose. When you look at it, like, Georgie Kelly went off, Buckley went off, they were so young by the end of the match nearly. Like,
oh, yeah.
You know, Tierney, Dawson, Devoy, Promise, Amachira, there was kids, Andy Lyons.
I think Lyons. 12 of the 22 were under 23 by the last few minutes of it. So
and that even all spills into in terms of the inexperience of that. That'll stand them in great stead to lose one. They could come back 2 or 3 years and they'll reflect on losing this and they'll actually cope with the occasion far better, maybe 3-4 years' time.
Alan, will St. Pat's be able to hang on to Stevie O'Donnell, do you think? Reports this morning suggesting that Dundalk are after him.
I can't believe you're actually asking me that, Marie, because I heard this last night and I couldn't believe it. Why would you leave St. Pat's now after the brilliant job that he's done, getting them to second, obviously winning the cup? He's a very good team. You would look to obviously...
Yeah, Marie, well, just for those of you that couldn't see, Marie was rubbing her hands together. She meant money, cash.
And not because she's cold, she wasn't rubbing her hands together. But yeah, I actually heard that last night, where I couldn't believe it, because...
Well, he was asked about it in the press conference afterwards as well, and people were saying, like, why are they asking him that? But then it started to filter through that he is the main target for Dundalk and Tim Clancy then, potentially, if he doesn't...
Yeah, and I understand why he's the main target, because of the connection that he has with the club, and he captained him through the glory years there, and they love him up there. And he's obviously proved that he's very good in terms of management as well.
Would he bring Robbie Benson back with him again?
Yeah, it'd be unbelievable. It's actually mad when you think, I was only thinking of Benson there when we were listening to the intro, because I remember Benson left to go to Pats and he was leaving Dundalk when they were in their pomp and everyone was thinking, what is Benson doing? And he actually came out in an interview and says, no, I'm going to go for a new challenge and I think we could win things with Pats. Here we are 2 years later and he takes the winning penalty. So it's mad how things transpire like that, but I'd be shocked if Stevie went to Dundalk, to be honest with you, Marie.
I can't believe we got 20 minutes out of the FA Guy Cup final, but we surely have. Stephen Kelly,
future,
I want to move
Ruby.
Forward anyway. What's that?
This is the future. This and is. You're very future, comfortable here as well, I have to say.
I know, yeah, it was enjoyable actually, which surprised me. Stephen, Ralph Ragnig. I was listening to him yesterday on Sky Sports with his 5 theories on soccer, which were all quite simple, but can he implement them at Manchester United?
Yeah, he can. Once the players buy into what he wants, and if... As a player, when a new manager comes in, if when they're talking to you and they're implementing their style and their shape, if you can see the benefits of it straight away, then you'll definitely go about it. There's loads of question marks about whether what's he going to do with Ronaldo, how can he get him on board, but you know, I think people are making more of an issue out of this than they need to. I think you've got a fantastic, unbelievable striker in your team that throughout centuries of football, years, hundreds of years of football, you die for a player like this and you work around getting the best out of him. So that's what they have to do. And I think, you know, he's a little unknown to most people. Yeah, people be lying if they tell you they know loads about this guy. He's kind of come out of nowhere. But, you know, he has got a good reputation. He's got a lot of good background with the teams he's coached. He likes the press. He likes the, you know, the gegenpress, all these things that he's done. And people are saying Ronaldo can't do it. And that's going to be an issue. I can't see it. I think you get the rest of the players around that team, have him work one way and get the best out of him. And you kind of think he's got to whip them into shape.
Alan, what do you think about Ronaldo and whether he would fit into Rangnick's plans or his philosophies? Already Ronaldo's getting so much criticism. We saw him been dropped yesterday and he seemed quite annoyed about it. But when you just think of, like, the reality is you do, okay, he gets the goal scoring stats as Roy Keane was pointing out on telly yesterday, but you do lose a bit out of possession with him.
Yeah, but sometimes, Marie, I think the narrative around Ronaldo since he's come back has been so unfair, because I've seen players playing that Man United team and I'm saying to myself, they're nowhere near the level, and we've all seen them obviously in recent weeks, and not only are they nowhere near the level, they don't look like they want to be anywhere near the level. Whereas you couldn't label that at Ronaldo. Every time I've watched him, he looks interested, he looks determined. There's games where obviously they're falling behind, he's trying to drag them back into the game. Of course he's not going to run around like maybe Firmino does at Liverpool, or that kind of high press that they work on, that's so good. But he's getting you goals every week, and imagine where Solskjaer would be if he wasn't. So I think it's very unfair at the moment in terms of that narrative, because he is 36, he is at the lesser side of his career. So I think I would agree with Stephen. I think you have to get a formation or some sort of way of playing where you're going to live with that and you get the others doing the donkey work around him. Now it'll be so interesting to see obviously Ragnick coming in, because as you say, I listened to that bit what Ruby was referring to, the 5 ways of playing, and we all know the German philosophy in terms of the high press and the high energy and the rock and roll football, whatever phrase you want to put on it. So I'm so intrigued to see, just because I've heard so much about this coach, I've read so much in the week about him, about just how good he is and what we can expect. So I'm so intrigued to see just exactly how he goes about trying to get the best out of these players.
Al, Solskjaer being the same place he is now, only he'd have been there sooner without Ronaldo. That's about the only difference. But Stephen, did Chelsea drop points against United at the weekend? Surely, even as a United fan, I can see they did.
Yeah, they did. And, you know, it was just a slip-up, wasn't it, Jorginho? Before you got to give United crowd, they absolutely pounced on him. Rashford and Sancho were there. They were sprinting. They were trying to put pressure on him. And Jorginho just, you know, takes his eye off the ball. And someone like him, a player who's normally so calm and collected in those situations. But they did push them. They were in the game for so long. Chelsea just looked so dominant at times. And, yeah, they had opportunities. Werner, good block. Last minute in the game, at times where they could have made the pass, and then you look at the volley at Rudiger, and he smashed over. Like, you'd obviously hoping for one of your centre forwards, maybe not Werner in that situation, but you'd hopefully that he puts that away. Definitely points dropped, but you know, new manager in charge, there's always a bounce from a team when they get that. So a point taken, it still keeps them in pole position, and like we've said on this show so many times, you just can't see them dropping many points at all throughout the season. And if you're going to have to be on top form to get near them, I think.
Alan, this league has turned into a three-horse race. We thought it would a long time ago, but it really is now. Chelsea are a point ahead of Man City, you're a point ahead of Liverpool. Liverpool were dominant at the weekend. Now it was Southampton, and Southampton probably expected the trimming they got.
Yeah, absolutely. And I would agree totally, Ruby. It is a three-horse race. And we always felt, like at the start of the season, a lot of people were tipping Chelsea and tipping City. But I always felt Liverpool would have a good say, because you'd think back of the injuries that they had last year, and of course Van Dijk comes back now, of all their players. And I always maintained, when they have their full complement of that first 11, 12 players, that they're as good as any team in terms of City and Chelsea. And that's what's been proven. You look at them again at the weekend, obviously Robertson came back in at left full and sets up the goal as well. And there's a little bit more competition for places, but I just think no matter who he brings in, you look at the midfield area, they've chopped and changed a lot maybe in the last 4 or 5 games, with even the likes of Oxlade-Chamberlain coming in and doing really well. Henderson, we see Thiago going out, the emergence of him in the last 2 or 3 weeks. So Liverpool will be right there. I've always been a fan of Klopp, as you know. I think they're absolutely brilliant, Liverpool, and they will push Chelsea and City right to the wire.
That's what's really setting those top three teams apart from everybody else, really, is the fact that they can rotate 6 changes for Klopp. And when you look as well at Pep and Manchester City at the weekend, and the names that are out with the likes of De Bruyne and Foden and Grealish, but it doesn't seem to be any bother to him at all, Stephen. He can just slot the players in. I think everybody was probably expecting a little bit better from West Ham, but another good win for Manchester City.
Yeah, it's just like for like, that's the beauty. Like, Chelsea and City have it in abundance, and Liverpool have improved their squad, and they've definitely got more to their disposal, especially when everybody's fit. But they've brought in players that can add to it. But City, like, at times this football they have played over the last kind of month, 6 weeks, has just been, it's been a joy to watch. Genuinely, they've played some absolutely exquisite stuff. No matter who's been on the pitch for them, they're passing, the movement, you know. The fact that they don't play with a centre forward, it doesn't matter. They, you know, interchanging of positions, and they just pull teams apart. For me, you're watching thinking like that what they can do in possession of the ball, and then out possession as well. The dark arts, those things we're talking about, they implement everything, and the press. So yeah, it really is. It's going to be so interesting if both of these teams, or all of these teams, the three of them, can keep pushing, because it makes it, for once, a really interesting race towards the end of the season.
For me, Marie, what separates them? Sorry, Ruby. For me, what separates them is the three managers. The managers are unbelievable, and with Stephen there, I agree. You're saying the players that were missing. I watched the match last week against PSG, and they had no De Bruyne, no Foden, no Grealish, but the players that were playing, obviously they're top quality players, but it's how well coached they are. It's unbelievable how well, like Guardiola and the coaching and the football that they play. And I know sometimes people like to be a bit hipsterish about it and kind of don't want to give him too much praise in terms of, oh, he's changed the face of football. But like, the way his teams play is absolutely outrageous, Marie. And you look at them last week against PSG, the level of football and the quality, it's just unbelievable. And those three managers for me are the difference.
I'm looking at their goal difference. Liverpool have scored 39 compared to Chelsea with 21 and Man City with 27. But Liverpool have nearly conceded as many as the other two put together. Are Liverpool going to have to tighten it up at the back if they're going to overhaul the other two, Alan?
Yeah, that's a good point, Ruby, and it's a good start, because I mentioned Van Dijk coming back in. Obviously, you would think that would shore things up, but they have leaked a few goals, a few sloppy ones. Chelsea's record is phenomenal, and I know Stephen referenced it there, and it was a mistake with the goal at the weekend, but I think that's only 5 they've conceded. So,
yeah.
In terms of you think of how strong they are going forward, and if they take the lead, which they would in the majority of matches, you're just looking at them thinking how many points are they going to drop, because they just don't concede goals. And again, that comes back to how well drilled they are. They have a bit of everything. What I love about the three teams as well, Ruby, they're so good, but the three of them all play in a different style. And I think that's brilliant as well, because we often hear the debates and the discussions around total football or Klopp's high press. Tuchel, what I love about Tuchel and Chelsea, they have a bit of everything. They're rock solid defensively, they work so hard, and yet they have the bit of the sprinkle of stardust up front with the players as well. So that's what I love, the contrast in styles with the three of them. And it just goes to show that there is no one way of winning, and those three managers prove that.
Yeah, and when the games do start coming thick and fast over Christmas, definitely tightening them up at the back would be so important. What about Steven Gerrard though, Stephen Kelly? A good win against Crystal Palace, 2-1, and getting off to a pretty decent start as his audition for a future Liverpool manager starts to take flight.
You're going to love this, aren't you? You're just close to keeping an eye on him working his way through to see when Klopp finally decides to off he goes, if Stevie G is ready to take over. It's like every Liverpool fan's dream, like when Klopp actually decides to move on. But no, he is, he's gone about his business. You know, it's Villa, and it's a huge club. They really are. They're a massive club in the area, but they needed some guidance. They need some movement. And, you know, initially he's going to get, when he comes in the door, he's going to get respect straight away from the players based on what he did as a player, and a little bit based on what he's done as a coach. But that can change really quickly as a manager, because not every player that comes in the door that was an absolute worldy of a footballer is an amazing coach, and the players will soon cut on to the fact that what he's telling them is what they think they should be doing. At the moment, it started off really well, and Villa, they got, you know, the results they've got since he's been in the door, again, that initial bounce that every team gets. You know, Watford try and do this three times a season to keep themselves up, change a manager, but you know, they've got a bounce straight away, and time will tell whether or not he's got the credentials and he's got the coaching style. But you know, his passion he shows, he's determined, and I think Villa, you know, they could be lucky with what he's got to do with them.
Alan, we're always talking about the top end of the table, but there's a massive clash tomorrow night at the bottom. Newcastle on 6 points play Norwich, who are just above them. Are they just both doomed, whatever they do?
Maybe not Newcastle, because it's going to be so interesting for them in January because of obviously the money and the takeover, and it'll be interesting to see, and they will have to bring in reinforcements, because I watched a game on Saturday morning against Arsenal, and I think they're one of the worst teams I've ever seen in the Premier League. Newcastle are absolutely horrendous, and I've watched them two or three times now, and again, it was no different. Arsenal, to be fair, were quite good, but that's an Arsenal team that Liverpool demolished last week as well, so they're only okay, and they were quite comfortable on Saturday beating Newcastle. As I say, Newcastle, Eddie Howe has such a big job on his hands there, but the big thing for them that probably edges it over the other teams at the bottom at the moment is January, obviously, because they'll be able to bring in reinforcements, and it's just a question of who to bring in, because we all know at the moment Eddie Howe is probably looking at that squad, and it's effectively championship players playing in that squad, so he knows more than anybody, and he's probably just trying to get to January, just trying to navigate that Christmas period without maybe dropping any more points or falling too far adrift, just being in contention with the rest, and then obviously bringing the reinforcements. So I wouldn't say they're doomed yet, but, and I don't, to be fair to Norwich, I think they've got a little bit of a bounce with Dean Smith, but they have a much bigger challenge on their hands staying in the league.
We do, of course, have a full complement of Premier League games between Tuesday and Thursday, including a Merseyside derby on Wednesday night. But Alan Colley and Stephen Kelly, thanks a million for talking to us. We're going to take a quick break.
Dinners made easy with Green Farm's high protein cooked chicken breast fillets range, available in selected stores nationwide.
Game on 2FM.
Now, welcome back. So the Republic of Ireland women's team are taking on Georgia in a crucial World Cup qualifier, and we will have live coverage on an extended Game On tomorrow evening, so do please tune in. Now we are going to turn our attention to rugby, and as we have learned from a little bit earlier, the Munster rugby squad have been cleared by the South Africans to return home. The Minister of State for Gaeltacht and Sport, Jack Chambers, was on the radio a little bit earlier, but there's still an awful lot of uncertainty about when and what will happen when they get home. Cian Tracy of the Irish Independent has been covering this story over the last number of days, and he joins us now on the line. Cian, what is the latest with the Munster rugby team?
Yeah, it's a good question, Marie. I suppose the best place to start is they're waiting on the latest round of PCR tests, which I think are due tomorrow. Obviously, they've already found that one member of the playing squad has tested positive. and another member of the squad has been deemed a close contact. So my understanding is that both of those people are now isolating in a separate hotel from the rest of the Munster squad in Cape Town. So, yeah, like well, you said there, they've been given permission to fly the unfortunate two people who have tested positive. Well, the one person who tested positive in the close contact, it sounds like they're going to have to stay for a bit longer, which is very tough.
Yeah, that is really tough. Sorry, Ruby, go on. Okay, I'll go on. It is very tough for them all, Keane, and like it's a big group as well, 48-person team heading or over there. But what's looming is the fact that they have European action coming up as well. And from what I can gather from reading what you're writing a little bit earlier, as it stands, they're not even sure who's going to be available to play and where they're going to be sourcing their players from. Is it from the academy or are the players going to be able to play when they return?
Yeah, you're right, Marie. There's just so many strands to this. Like, you obviously have the, you know, the concern from the health-wise, like, because the, I suppose the new variant, it's such an unknown, and that's got to be a concern from the guys. You mentioned there, their two games in South Africa have been postponed, and yeah, they've got the first Champions Cup game coming up next week, and like, even if they were allowed to play, it'll have been 7 weeks before Munster will have played a game, which is just crazy to think, but there's a lot of uncertainty around if the 34-man squad who are in South Africa, like you said, will be allowed play. Now, my understanding is that Ian Costello, who is the Munster Academy manager, took training today in UL at the High Performance Centre, which involved the likes of Conor Murray, Joey Carberry, the Ireland internationals, basically, Damien D'Alende, along with the academy players. So my understanding is that they were told that, you know, you've got to train here as if you're going to be involved in the Champions Cup game next week, which is a bizarre scenario, really, when you think about it. There's a lot of those guys who won't even have played a senior game for Munster before. So the word from EPCR, the tournament organisers of the Champions Cup, is that the game is going to go ahead. So that throws up all sorts of problems for Munster, because if they weren't able to fulfil the fixture, it would be deemed a 28-point-nil defeat, which is obviously far from ideal.
That would be a poor way to start the European Cup for Munster. But look, some players' loss would be other players' gains, and we'll see what happens. But look, we did have URC rugby at the weekend here with a Leinster-Ulster match at the RDS, which saw Leinster lose an unbeaten home record, and they were played off the park by Ulster.
Yeah, they were. A bit of a turn-up for the books, and, you know, we don't often see Leo Cullen angry, I guess, because it's rare that Leinster lose, but he really threw it back on his players. You know, he called it a wake-up call, a kick in the backside, and, you know, no team ever wants to lose, like, that's stating the obvious, but maybe it is a bit of a wake-up call for this Leinster team. Leo Cullen kind of mentioned that maybe a lot of the players were buying into the hype around this team, so I think you've got to give all the credit to Ulster, though. I mean, they came into the game under huge pressure, having been comfortably beaten by Connacht just before the break, which was also in Dublin, of course. And they got a response that Dan McFarlane wanted, and it sets up, I suppose, the Connacht game this weekend for Leinster. It becomes an even bigger game than what it was already. Like, Connacht's banging form, and Leo Cullen now has his Ireland internationals back in training from today. But I guess the bigger picture is a lot of the guys who played last week, like, they fluffed their lines and they've missed their chance now for bigger games to come, which Leo Cullen admitted.
Yeah, and that's what Ruby pointed out there as well. You know, you get these opportunities, and there will be an opportunity, it looks like, for Munster players to go out and try and impress when they get the chance. And was it simply a case of that, Cian, that the fringe players, they didn't take their chance and they probably won't get one again for a while?
Yeah, in a squad as big as Leinster's and as competitive, like, chances are kind of few and far between. And if you don't take your chance, there's another guy waiting in the wings to take it. So this season is a bit different as well. We've obviously just come off the back of a four-week break for the URC, which meant that, you know, a lot of the fringe guys didn't get to play during the November window, which would ordinarily be the case. So that obviously lessens the kind of the shop window, if you like, for guys to impress, which puts an even greater emphasis on the games like last week. They had 4 weeks, you know, to prepare for it. They would have known that the Ireland internationals, most of them at least, weren't going to be involved. And I don't know, for whatever reason, they took their eye off the ball. They were poor around the breakdown. They fell foul of the referee. And I thought like it was pretty admirable that Leo Cullen like refused to sort of blame the ref in any way. He gave Ulster his credit and he put it back in his players. So you'd imagine there'll be a big, big response this week from Leinster, but it's going to be from, you know, the likes of the guys who we saw playing for Ireland in November rather than the guys who you would have been wanting to see step up, because I guess in normal matters, like Leinster will be using it as a game, as a building block to going into the Champions Cup next week, which is something that Munster are not going to have. So you're going to see a pretty strong team use it as a stepping stone going into Europe next week.
Was there a couple of ex-Leinster guys making a little bit of a point at the RDS? Nick Timoney, Marty Moore, they had big games for Ulster.
They absolutely did, yeah. I mean, that's always a bit of a subplot with all the provinces, I guess, when they're playing Leinster, but there's a lot of ex-Leinster guys in the Ulster setup. And yeah, like, I think Nick Timoney, Ruby, you're right to touch on him. He's had a pretty good kind of 7 days. Obviously, a couple of weeks ago, he came off the bench for Ireland. He wasn't even supposed to be in the squad. And he made a big impression when he came off the bench. I thought he played really well. And last week at the RDS, I thought he was the best player in the pitch. I was really surprised he didn't get player of the match. Dominated the breakdown. And yeah, you're right, probably played like a guy with a point to prove. You know, he was let go by Leinster. He's really reinvented himself since he's gone up to Belfast. And when you think in the back of his mind, he knows that, you know, there's a South African World Cup winner in Dwayne Vermeulen arriving in Belfast today, I believe it is. So he's really kind of looks to make that open side position his own, and I think he becomes a realistic target for Ireland now as well, coming up in the Six Nations, because that's going to be his aim ultimately. The competition is so tough in that back row, but I think over the last 2 weeks he's done his chances no harm at all.
It was interesting to hear James Hume after the game as well. He scored that intercept try, but just to even give a little bit of insight into what it's like to not make the squad for those Ireland test games and how difficult it was for him. He said that it was probably the toughest 3 weeks that he's had to deal with mentally, and he went down to camp and he tried to learn as much as possible. But for him to actually come out and say how much he wants it was just, I found it pretty refreshing actually, Cian.
Yeah, like one of the things, like Ireland had such a positive November series, but one of the things that kind of maybe went a bit under the radar was the fact that there was a lot of guys in the squad who didn't play at all. That's unheard of really in a November window, because normally you kind of would play a tier two nation and you'd see a lot of the guys get their run out there, but there was a good few, including James Hume, like you mentioned. Stuart McCloskey was another one who he played in midfield with the other night. Excuse me, they had a point to prove, and yeah, like he's a young guy. He's a young guy with a point to prove, like I said, but he was outstanding as well. You know, the intercept try was the icing on the cake, but he also created the opening try, which Greg Jones scored. So yeah, he's a confident guy, isn't he? Kind of saw it in the celebration. It was a bit like kind of almost like a soccer-esque celebration. Are you not entertained? But I think you want to see that bit of personality, don't you, in the young players. And he said it himself, he wrote it down in his notebook, that it's a goal to get back into the Six Nations squad. And I think Europe and the Interpros are where these guys are being judged. You know, we can kind of beat around the bush about the other URC games if we want, but ultimately it's the Interpros when you're going up against directly Irish rivals, and the big European games are where Andy Farrell is looking at. And for guys like James Hume and Nick Timoney, they really stake their claim.
They sure did, and I thought there was a couple of lads wearing green over in Galway pretty much doing the same thing against the Ospreys. I thought Jack Carty really controlled that game. Mac Hansen and Connacht are really in form at that, stating the obvious, but they're going to go to Dublin with their tails up.
Yeah, it should be an absolute cracker. I mean, for Connacht to play the way they did in, you want to say classic Galway weather, but it almost looked worse than what you kind of expected out there. But it's just their commitment to play to the game, to the game plan that Andy Friend wants them is just so admirable. I think their recruitment policy has been outstanding. You mentioned Mac Hansen. He's got 5 tries in 6 games now. Even Shane Bolton, a 21-year-old centre, you know, he's from South Africa, Cork-born mother. It kind of goes back to what Andy Friend said at the start of the year. It's a bit like shopping in Aldi as opposed to Brown Thomas for Connacht, but they're getting their recruitment spot on. They're not afraid to, you know, unearth these hidden gems. And yeah, you're right, they scored 6 tries. They were all by backs in the gale force wind. You'd have to say that was pretty impressive. But for someone like Jack Carty, I think his Irish chances are going to be massively helped by the fact that we saw over the last month. Ireland are playing a similar kind of game plan to what Connacht play now. And I think that will really, really allow Carty to thrive a little bit more, because I think in the past, when he was coming into international camp, he was being asked to play a much different way than what he was used to. So I think that's one to watch over the next few weeks, because if Carty can retain this form and even push on a little bit when Connacht start their Champions Cup campaign, I'd imagine he'll be very close to getting back into the Six Nations squad.
And Keane, just finally, we also saw Keir Griffin and Lindsay Peat signing off their international careers with a very impressive performance for the Barbarians at the weekend, beating South Africa 65 at Twickenham.
Yeah, it was a perfect send-off for them, wasn't it? There was like so many enjoyable clips, like Keir Griffin soloing the ball down the line was pretty unique. But yeah, it was nice for them to have that moment. You know, it's been a tough few weeks, a couple of months for them, particularly someone like Keir Griffin, who's made the difficult decision to retire at, what is she, 27? So, I mean, she's proved her quality over the last two games with Ireland in the wins over Japan and America, particularly in the Japan game. But it just shows what the calibre of players that Ireland are losing, and she leaves a massive void that needs to be filled. And the same with Lindsay Peat. Like, you can just only have huge admiration for a player like that who has done it across multiple codes, still going strong at 41. And she's been a linchpin of that Irish scrum as well. So they're big boots to fill, and Greg McWilliams is coming in as head coach. He's got a big job in his hands, which is stating the obvious, but replacing players like Lindsay Peat and Keir Griffin are, I'd say, top of his priority list.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you so much, Keane, as always, and I look forward to seeing what the latest developments are on that whole saga with Munster. It is definitely complicated, that is for sure. We're going to take a very quick break, and then we're back with racing.
Game on 2FM with Green Firm. Fuel your day with Green Firm's high protein cooked chicken breast fillet. 100% natural and packed with flavour.
Game on 2FM.
Welcome back. So, Ruby, you were busy at the weekend. I saw you here, there, and everywhere at racing.
Yeah, I was, Marie. I was here, there and everywhere. I was in Newbury Friday and Saturday, and then I was in Ferryhouse yesterday, which was a very enjoyable afternoon. Great to see such big crowds back at an Irish racecourse. And obviously Honeysuckle was the star attraction, and everyone that came to Saur most certainly got entertained.
Well, I'm going to put you on the spot now. I'm going to give you 2.5 minutes to tell us everything. Everything that happened over the weekend.
Everything about the weekend or
the
just yesterday?
The whole weekend. All the highlights. What we need to know.
Start at the beginning. That's Honeysuckle was definitely the star attraction with Rachel Blackmore. She was bidding for a third win in the Hatton's Grace Hurdle to emulate Apples Jade, Solarina, Limestone Lad, and she did it. And she was obviously fitter mare this time this year than she was 12 months ago, because Rachel Blackmore committed her with sort of 5 furlongs to Rona off a really strong gallop set by Stormy Island, and she absolutely careered away to beat Ronald Pump, who she beat last year. And Abracadabra was back in third. He was probably slightly disappointing the way he travelled and jumped for Davy Russell, but Honeysuckle was just really, really good on the day. We've come to expect it from her, and she was spectacular. And herself and Rachel Blackmore are really becoming the stars of the sport. Yesterday as well, you had obviously the Royal Bond Novice Hurdle, and a bit of a surprise there. My mate Mozzie was the favourite. He made a mistake at the last, and that opened the door for Statuaire under Danny Mullins, for Willie Mullins actually, to come and nab my mate Mozzie on the line. And Darragh O'Keefe and Gavin Cromwell will be cursing the last jumps at Ferryhouse, because Gabby Narco's jumping, whilst it had fallen apart over the last five, a bad mistake at the last cost him as well. And Dennis O'Regan pounced late on Beacon Edge for Noel Mead to nab him in the Drimmore Novices Chase. Dennis followed up with a quick double then on Smoking Gun for Gordon Elliott in the Porterstown Handicap Chase, and they were two really good rides from well off the pace on two horses that I couldn't see winning beforehand, but they're the most important ones to win on. Fieldor was a really good winner of the 3-year-old hurdle as well. And in Ferryhouse on Saturday, Brian Cooper had a spectacular day when he landed a treble on Lieutenant Command, Dun Vegan and Grangy in the maiden hurdle. Big day for him, and he's most certainly taken the opportunity he's getting with the injuries to other riders. Across the pond, we were out of luck, the Marine, the Ladbrokes Trophy. Ireland had 4 runners. Henry de Bromhead ran Eclat de Rear, who was favourite under Rachel Blackmore. He pulled up. That said, maybe the ground was a bit quick for him, but he never really got going, to tell you the truth. Anna Mix fell at the second last, and whilst Bramma Bull ran on to finish third and on the ropes was fourth, they were never really in the race. Cloudy Glenn won it for Venetia Williams and Charlie Deutsch, and I thought Fiddler on the Roof ran a pretty good race to finish second for the Tizzards and Brendan Powell, and they're talking about going for the King George with him. It'll be interesting to see if they do or they don't, but yeah, it was a really good performance for Cloudy Glenn and the colours of the late Trevor Hemmings. His memorial service was on last week. Of course, I rode a Grand National winner for him on Hedge Hunter, so a pretty poignant victory for him. A High Senor was probably the eye-catcher at Newbury on Saturday for Lucinda Russell and Derek Fox, of course, who's from Sligo. A High Senor, he won the Sefton Novice Hurdle last year at Aintree, and he put in a pretty good performance in the Novice Chase at Newbury on Saturday to beat Mr. Incredible of Henry de Bromheads, and he looks like an RSA horse. And not so sleepy in Epitant, dead heated in the Fighting Fifth at Newcastle. Neither of them are going to scare Honeysuckle, but two Irish jockeys got a share of the spoils in Aidan Coleman and Johnny Burke.
Well done, Ruby. You got it all in there. But we're out of time now, I'm afraid. That is it from us for today. We'll be back tomorrow. Connor Bean is up next. 2FM.
Game on 2FM. With Green Fern. Have your dinner ready in a flash. With Green Fern's high-protein cooked chicken breast fillet. Available in selected stores nationwide. 2FM.